Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the black community. This week, I'll have a book review from Kirkus Reviews about a new Jesse Jackson biography, followed by readings from two chapters of that book, which is titled A Dream Deferred, Jesse Jackson and the Fight for Black Political Power. I'll have news about a college scholarship in California from the Imperial Valley Press newspaper, followed by an opinion piece about training scientists from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. And I'm starting with this. What happens when a conservative group visits an HBCU homecoming? This was published October 26, 2025 in the Washington Post newspaper and was written by Amber Ferguson, Samantha Cherry, Taylor Swinton, and Zoe Cummings. Howard University's homecoming, a celebration of black culture and pride, collided with conservative politics Friday, October 24th, when the Turning Point USA-backed Blackxit movement showed up uninvited as part of the organization's Educate to Liberate tour of historically black campuses. The visit came weeks after the fatal shooting of Turning Point's USA co-founder, Charlie Kirk, thrust the movement into a new national spotlight. But Blackxit's frosty reception at Howard and other schools suggest that Kirk's near martyr-like status among conservatives is not translating to young black people. On the outskirts of Yardfest, the annual campus concert that draws thousands to the school's famed quad, two groups faced off. On one side, a man with bulging muscles and a microphone interviewed a group of event-goers while a cameraman donning a American First baseball cap videoed for Blackxit. Just a few feet away, members of a counter-movement waved a handmade sign that read, "Blackxit equals black people for white supremacist fascism." Now in its third year, Blackxit's outreach effort is aimed at recruiting students from historically black colleges and universities to form campus clubs and, as the group says, think for themselves. The group's arrival during homecoming weekend sparked the latest flashpoint in a broader debate over what voices and ideologies belong on HBCU campuses. For Howard, known as the Mecca of black excellence in political thought, it was another charged moment on its storied yard, a space that hosted Kamala Harris's election night watch party, helped launch model Anak Yai's career, and even saw an appearance from the notorious B.I.G. in 1995. When Blackxit said its group would be returning to the prominent HBCU and others across the country in the wake of Kirk's death, many students and alumni of the schools with small conservative contingents derided the decision. Howard University advised the community to be wary in an email to students last week, which did not specifically mention Blackxit. In these challenging times, you may notice individuals who may agitate or attempt to distract you from your purpose on or near our campus, it read. While it may be natural to have curiosity about these events, we strongly encourage you not to engage with individuals or groups whose actions may disrupt the celebratory atmosphere or the environment of mutual respect that we all work so diligently to maintain. What transpired on campus registered more like a mild commotion. Washington Post reporters watched Blackxit contributor Stephen Davis approach mostly men with questions about how members of the black community could uplift themselves through entrepreneurship and financial leadership. Davis wore no Blackxit or Turning Point identifiers. "I usually don't say I'm with this group. I just say I'm Stephen," he told the Post. "I'm just out here to have conversations." Some onlookers side-eyed the spectacle or declined to participate, muttering statements like, "I'm not trying to be seen," as they walked away. Summer Johnson, an economics and philosophy student at Howard, said she felt unsettled by Blackxit's presence. To her, the group's conservative values represented support for defunding federal jobs like the one her mom has. From their perspective, it's very strategic. "You're coming to one of the biggest events at Howard, and I feel like a lot of people that are here are pretty liberal," she said. The movement, she believes, came to get people riled up, knowing how upset and emotional people get about the group's talking points. But Sam Mahmoud Al-Hassan, a Howard student who conversed with Davis, said their conversation about entrepreneurship and financial literacy was important. "That's very good awareness that should be spread more in the black community," he said. "I believe that's a very good thing that he's spreading." Pierre Wilson, the senior director of Blexit, attended the University of Maryland Eastern Shore for 3 years before transferring to Salisbury University to study political science. "I was elected class president at an HBCU," he said, referring to Eastern Shore. "That experience," he said, "informs why Blexit's tour targets HBCUs. I know from personal experience, there is a need for a different perspective on those campuses," Wilson, 36, said. "The goal," he explained, "isn't to provoke, but to expose students to viewpoints they rarely hear. We're not there to cause chaos. We're there to have honest conversations, open dialogue, really meet the students, learn why they believe what they believe, share some of our beliefs, and give them the full puzzle." According to Wilson, Blexit has a presence on 21 college campuses. 17 of these unofficial clubs were formed as a direct result of the tour. He sees that growth as proof that the outreach is resonating. "Still," he said, "the biggest pushback hasn't come from students. It's come from administrators." He said at some universities, "faculty have worked overtime to block us." Even so, Wilson insists that the group's mission is to encourage young black students to think on their own and make political choices grounded in independent thought, not inherited loyalty. "If they walk away and still lean left, that's fine," he said. "What matters is that they've heard both sides and made the decision for themselves." Davis said many people have misconceptions about Blexit. "We care deeply about the black community. We just have different ways of going about it. The goal is still the same: empowerment, self-sufficiency, entrepreneurship, and education," he told the Post. "I want to stay away from politics. Ultimately, that's not the issue within the black community. The issue is the culture. We have to fix the culture, remedy the culture. I'm about uplifting the black community out of the shackles that we're in and uplifting us to a higher plane, starting with the mind and in the family." Shortly after Blexit staked out a spot across from local black vendors, protesters from the organization Refuse Fascism rolled up with a flashier presentation. In a tense moment, pedestrians stared as campus police talked to Refuse Fascism activist Lucha Bright and examined the posters the group was wheeling around in a cart. Afterward, Refuse Fascism simply moved closer to where Blexit was interviewing. Bright and a handful of other protesters stood close to Davis for the next couple of hours, wearing bright orange shirts and handing out flyers that read, "Trump must go now." But the two groups weren't seen directly interacting. "You have this Blexit group coming to Howard, promoting those ideas and being a black face on white supremacy," Bright told the Post, noting that Kirk opposed the Civil Rights Act. "That is dangerous for black people, and it's dangerous for humanity. I know they have black representatives, but they are a minority of black society," said another protester, Ralph Nix. "They think if they're on the side of the regime, they're going to be protected while everybody else is taken advantage of." Despite the pushback members of Blexit have received, they remain resolute. They're hoping to peel away the stigma many black people hold against black conservatives. While some data suggests Donald Trump won a historic share of the black vote in the 2024 election, the demographic still overwhelmingly voted for Harris. Conservative groups such as Blexit, Turning Point USA, and College Republicans have struggled to find a foothold on historically black college and university campuses. The university's community questioned whether it would actually happen, and if it did, whether it would attract a sizable audience. A month into the HBCU tour, the Turning Point-powered campaign has lacked a large social media footprint. The group posted a video to Instagram that it suggested showed a Howard student criticizing conservative Christianity. In fact, the video appears to have been shot at Johnson C. Smith University in North Carolina. At other stops, the group wasn't even allowed to stay. Officials at Tennessee State University asked Blexit members to leave the school grounds when they stopped by on October 17th. A stop at Florida A&M University's homecoming, scheduled for the same day, was canceled by Blexit at the last minute without a new date confirmed. There was also confusion at Howard regarding who would show up to represent Blexit. Promotional tour material named six influencers: Craig Long, Savannah Craven and Tao, Siaka Masakoi, Davis, Toffer, and Anthony Watson. But only one of them showed, along with the videographer and a Blexit influencer who goes by Price. Only one Blexit-affiliated Howard student was seen at the event, a volunteer who declined to be interviewed for fear of retribution from the school. Also missing from the tour stop was the conservative influencer many associate with Blexit, Candace Owens, who co-founded the group during Trump's first term in an effort to coax black people away from the Democratic Party. Owens has stepped away from the movement since it merged with Turning Point in 2023, but she is still featured prominently on Blexit's website. She has recently been advancing conspiracy theories about Kirk's death on her podcast and blaming Turning Point's leaders for opposing her investigation. Turning Point USA took over Blexit years ago, and this was all done in public. If you weren't aware of this, maybe you shouldn't be covering this topic. There is no story here, a representative for Owens wrote in an email. Owens' name didn't come up much during Blexit's three-hour stop at Howard. Davis didn't mention Kirk much either in his conversations with students, for that matter. Aside from the protests, the afternoon unfolded without incident. When the group packed up its equipment, a few students and staff lingered near the yard asking, "Who was that big guy with the muscles?" Davis and his cameraman soon headed to the airport, bound for Phoenix, where Turning Point USA's headquarters are. Before leaving, Davis said, "The vibes were great," adding that the conversations with students were exactly what the group had hoped for. "This is what it's all about," he said. That was the Washington Post news article titled, "What Happens When a Conservative Group Visits an HBCU Homecoming?" It was published October 26, 2025, and was written by Amber Ferguson, Samantha Cherry, Taylor Swinton, and Zoe Cummings. My next reading is out of California and appeared in the Imperial Valley Press newspaper, which is a newspaper out of El Centro, California. The title of the article is, "A Scholarship for Black California Students Has to Accept White Applicants. Here's Why." This was written by Adam Eichelman and published Friday, October 24th, 2025, in the Imperial Valley Press newspaper. A scholarship for black students at the University of California, San Diego is now available to anyone, regardless of race, after students in a right-leaning nonprofit organization sued the university for discrimination this July. The plaintiffs argued that the scholarship fund violated a series of laws, including the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, which was put in place to protect black Americans in the South. One of the students, Kai Peters, said he was denied access to the scholarship because he isn't black. Peters sent a written statement to Cal Matters through the Californians for Equal Rights Foundation, the nonprofit plaintiff. He said his lack of access is an example of institutionalized racism, a phrase that was created in part to characterize how government institutions discriminate against black Americans. "I don't see the irony," said Joshua Thompson, an attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, which represented the plaintiffs. "The idea is that we don't want government actors outforcing their discrimination. The Black Alumni Scholarship Fund for UC San Diego students is now called the Goins Alumni Scholarship Fund, named after its founding donor, Lennon Goins, according to a press release last week. Its website says each scholarship is worth $2,500 and that 275 scholarships have been awarded since 2016. The rebranded scholarship program is just one of numerous initiatives in California that have come under scrutiny in the last 2 years. In 2023, the Supreme Court overturned precedent that allowed private universities in the state to use affirmative action, and this year, the Trump administration has ended numerous campus initiatives promoting diversity. In March, the University of California changed its hiring practices, banning its 10 campuses from requiring diversity statements as a condition for employment. Now those statements are voluntary. Other changes are more subtle. In February, Bakersfield College described its Chicano/Latino pre-commencement event as a means to encourage Chicano/Latino students to participate in graduation celebrations. But by the time graduation rolled around in May, the word Chicano and Latino had been removed from that sentence. The next part of the article is titled, Website Indicates Change of Focus. The press release about the Black Alumni Scholarship Fund didn't address the reason for the change, and a spokesperson for the San Diego Foundation, Hiram Soto, declined to comment further. But a CalMatters analysis of the fund's website shows how the university changed course. In September, the website said the University Scholarship Fund was founded in 1983 by Goins to expand educational opportunities for high-achieving, civic-minded African-American students, focusing on admitted black students with a record of community service and resiliency to racial and other identity challenges. There was no mistake that this fund was by and for the black community. 100% of BASF scholars identify as black African-American. The website said, adding that the goal of the scholarship fund was to increase black graduation at University of California, San Diego from 2% to 5% of degrees awarded. Despite decades of scholarships, that goal remains unattained. In the 2023-2024 school year, just under 3% of UC San Diego's undergraduate degrees awarded went to students who identify as black or African American according to the system's data. Racial discrimination is illegal in the United States, but in California, the standard of what constitutes discrimination depends in part on whether an entity is public or private. While private entities, including nonprofits and foundations, have long offered scholarships and programs for certain racial or ethnic groups, arguing that spending money is a form of free speech, state agencies, including the University of California campuses, are prohibited from any form of affirmative action after California voters passed Proposition 209 in 1996. To avoid legal scrutiny, University of California San Diego moved the Black Alumni Scholarship Fund to the private San Diego Foundation in 1998, according to the September iteration of the fund's website. But in the lawsuit, Thompson and his legal team alleged that the university has remained involved in the scholarship's operation. Our allegations were that the University of California San Diego officials were conspiring with a private entity to get around Proposition 209 and the Equal Protection Clause. Specifically, he said that the university was giving the San Diego Foundation information about which students identified as black on their college applications, and that the leadership of the fund included some university officials. The Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 prohibits government agencies from using private entities to discriminate. That was the article, A Scholarship for Black California Students Has to Accept White Applicants. Here's why. This was published in the Imperial Valley Press newspaper on Friday, October 24, 2025, and was written by Adam Eichelman. My next reading is an opinion piece titled, Feds Use DEI Excuse to Kill Scientists Training Program. This opinion piece was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Sunday, October 26, 2025, and was written by Tiffany Oliver, Trisha Hendrickson, Tanisha Stubbs, Valerie Haftel, and Gitanajal Gadanasiskian. In August, the federal government terminated a 25-year program that trained more than 200 research scientists to be effective college teachers. Fellowship in Research and Science Teaching, or FIRST, was a collaboration between Morehouse College, Spelman College, Clark Atlanta University, and Morehouse School of Medicine, all historically black institutions, and Emory University. Funded by the National Institutes of Health, FIRST postdoctoral scientists engaged in research at Emory while participating in dedicated training for teaching college-level science and then teaching at partner schools in Atlanta. FIRST was canceled, along with hundreds of other grants, as part of the Trump administration's push to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. University administrators received messages from the Department of Health and Human Services saying such programs were harmful and provided a low return on investment. We believe the record of the FIRST program represents a clear contrast with the government's boilerplate assertion. The FIRST program has been extraordinarily successful at producing cutting-edge scientific research, building expertise in college teaching, and developing the leadership potential of a generation of scientists. The next part of the article is titled, Grant Recipients Have Gone On to Esteemed Careers. FIRST fellows have published papers on topics such as sickle cell anemia, chronic pain, cystic fibrosis, emerging pathogens, sanitation resiliency to disasters, and primate cognition. Unlike many programs that focus only on research, FIRST fellows have dedicated time for developing their teaching skills through practice, experimentation, and research. Thus, FIRST fellows have also published on best practices for effective science teaching, including strategies to foster student-to-student interactions in online courses and the use of immersive virtual reality to enhance engagement with complex biological concepts. The impact of FIRST can be seen here in Atlanta. Many faculty at Spelman and Morehouse were FIRST fellows and now serve as mentors for current fellows. FIRST fellows developed a variety of courses that continue to be taught, such as the Biology of Women course at Spelman, which became the premier biology course for non-majors. At Morehouse College, fellows developed courses in cancer biology that facilitated students' participation in research studies, and a course in men's health, which is now part of the Morehouse College general education curriculum. Competition in academia is fierce, with more graduates than academic jobs. So a key metric for postdoctoral training programs is their placement of scientists in jobs within academia or industry. Over the first 20 years, 70% of FIRST fellows landed in academia, with approximately half of those in primarily teaching roles. 14% landed in industry positions at companies such as Eli Lilly, Boston Scientific, Regeneron, and Indivior. And 9% in governmental agencies such as the Food and Drug Administration. Many FIRST fellows report they would not have continued in science careers if they had not participated in a program like FIRST. FIRST was so successful that Emory School of Medicine tapped program leaders to run additional professional development programs for all postdoctoral scientists. The next part of the article is titled, National Institute of Health Head Once Said Developing Bioscientists Was Top Priority. FIRST was the longest continuously running Institutional Research and Academic Career Development Awards, and along with other IRADCA programs across the country, established a successful model for developing 21st century world-class scientists who are now training the next generation of the STEM workforce. Many students taught by FIRST fellows in Atlanta have been inspired to pursue careers in science, some even becoming IRACDA fellows themselves. When the National Institute of Health evaluated IRACDA outcomes in 2016, they concluded it was extraordinarily effective. At the time, IRACDA alumni were professors in 45 of 50 states, bringing their scientific and teaching expertise to students around the country. All of these programs lost their NIH funding this year. In a statement published on August 15th, NIH Director Jay Bhattacharya listed training biomedical scientists as the agency's first priority. This is exactly what IRACDA programs like EMRE first did, train scientists to excel in careers critical for the future of our country. The Trump administration's attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at the NIH appears to reflect a belief that such programs are inherently waste, fraud, and abuse, as well as the distrust that has grown between some Americans and the scientific community. However, in a recent Economist YouGov poll, a majority, 56% of Republicans, said that federal research funding for American universities should increase or stay the same, compared to only 22% who said it should decrease. Our society needs skilled scientists, teachers, and communicators. But rather than investing in the future of U.S. science, our government is eliminating successful programs using DEI as a scapegoat. What if instead we fund science, fund scientist training, and watch society reap the benefits? That was an opinion piece titled, "Feds Use DEI Excuse to Kill Scientist Training Program." It was written by Tiffany Oliver, Trisha Hendrickson, Tanisha Stubbs, Valerie Haftel, and Gitanajal Gadanasiskian. This opinion piece was published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on Sunday, October 26, 2025. The remainder of today's African American Hour will be taken up with a review and reading an excerpt from the book, A Dream Deferred: Jesse Jackson and the Fight for Black Political Power, written by Abby Phillip. This review is from KirkusReviews.com and was published October 1st, 2025. A sympathetic yet nuanced examination of the civil rights leader's complex legacy. In this incisive account of the trailblazing and often controversial civil rights leader and presidential candidate, CNN anchor Phillip brings a seasoned reporter's sharp research and keen insight to the inner workings and significant accomplishments of this complicated but compelling figure. Phillip traces Jackson's formative years in Greenville, South Carolina, from discovering his birth father was a married neighbor who had impregnated his teenage mother, through his college experiences with segregation that propelled him into civil rights activism, and eventually to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference under Martin Luther King, Jr. Jackson's presence at King's assassination and his subsequent news appearances in a bloodied shirt created lasting tensions within the movement's leadership, as peers suspected opportunism. As Phillip notes, those tense days made Jesse Jackson infamous and planted the seeds of suspicion among his peers and the King family that would never really go away. The core of Phillip's narrative examines Jackson's groundbreaking presidential campaigns, particularly his 1988 run, when he secured several primary victories before finishing second to Michael Dukakis. These historic efforts would later pave the way for Barack Obama's successful campaigns, though Phillip acknowledges that Shirley Chisholm had blazed an even more challenging trail as a black female candidate. Jackson's charismatic media presence and faith-infused speeches built an unlikely coalition extending beyond the black community to marginalized white voters, including struggling Midwest farmers. As Phillip explains, the coalition he sought was one that intended to unite marginalized groups and whites to create a powerful majority and would tie together aims of racial, gender, and religious justice with commonly held economic demands. This ambitious vision became Jackson's signature political strategy. Noting a striking irony, Phillips suggests that Donald Trump's populist outsider campaign may have done more to validate Jackson's 1980s blueprint than Obama's historic victory. An admiring yet unflinching portrait convincingly weighing Jackson's contributions against his contradictions. That was a review of the book, A Dream Deferred, Jesse Jackson and the Right for Black Political Power, written by Abby Phillip. This review appeared at the website KirkusReviews.com. Next, I will be reading two excerpts from the book. The first is from the website Macmillan Company, and it's Macmillan.com website, which is the publisher of the book. This book is available as an audiobook. Chapter 1. Up from Greenville. Several years ago, on a mild day in January, decades after he left for college, after he joined the civil rights movement and after his long career in activism and politics, Jesse Jackson returned home. Even all those years later, his arrival was something of a homecoming, even if a muted one. The city's black residents emerged to give him the treatment he was accustomed to. His driver was a genial middle-aged man who had been a member of Jackson's own Omega Psi Phi fraternity. Jackson arrived at the Hyatt, his preferred hotel chain for decades, and set up shop in the hotel restaurant dining room, which was eerily quiet in the fallout from the global COVID-19 pandemic. I had convinced him to take me on a tour of his hometown so I could get a sense of his upbringing. Greenville's downtown is still quaint, if increasingly gentrifying amid a resurgence of interest in small but educated southern towns and suburbs. For all that has changed since the 1950s, it was striking to see Jackson reminisce about his childhood. Jackson had retained an almost photographic memory of his hometown. Turn right," he instructed his driver, who followed dutifully after taking a few seconds to comprehend Jackson's words, slowed as they were by Parkinson's disease. Turn by turn, Jackson guided us past the mansions of the city's now wealthy enclaves, the small churches that were once the center of black life, the football stadium where he once sold peanuts to make a few dollars. We pulled up to his old neighborhood. The modest house stood vacant, its wood cracked and its whitewash paint faded. Jackson, who had recently turned 80, struggled to exit the vehicle, but he insisted. Two of his closest longtime aides pulled his 6'3" frame from the SUV and helped him up the curb. Jackson perched himself unsteadily on the stone steps. "My father lived there," he said, gesturing to a neighboring home with green trim not 10 feet from his mother's house. "There was a lot of drama around my birth." Speaking to Jackson about his father can be confusing. He uses the descriptor freely, referring both to Charles Henry Jackson, his adoptive father, and to his biological father, whom he didn't meet until he was 10 years old. Charles, a soft-spoken post office maintenance worker, adopted Jesse after he married the boy's mother, Helen Burns, when Jesse was still an infant. Though he moved into their ramshackle Haney Street residence, Charles soon joined the army and was sent overseas to fight in World War II. To make ends meet, Helen decided to become a seamstress. They had a neighbor on the street, Noah Robinson. For years, Jesse would walk past Robinson's home with the obliviousness of a child. Robinson was an imposing former boxer who now worked as a cotton grader for a white-owned firm. He was also married, a stepfather to 3 children and nearly twice Helen's age. On the rare occasions that Noah and Jesse talked, Jesse appeared enthralled by Noah's tales of his boxing exploits. Under the name K.O. Robinson, Noah had won 18 of his 19 bouts in Greenville's grimy textile hall. When Jesse was about 10, his maternal grandmother, Tibby, revealed a shocking truth. The tall, muscular, amber-hued man next door was Jesse's birth father. Robinson had no involvement in raising Jesse, although Tibby would often stomp next door to demand food and milk for her daughter and grandson. The Robinsons weren't wealthy, but in a poor, segregated black community, Noah Robinson was considered successful. Jesse's envy of Noah's other children nearly overwhelmed him. He also struggled with feelings of resentment and anger toward his mother and stepfather for their own continued impoverishment. He would sometimes stand for as long as an hour at the brick wall outside of Noah's new front yard, and stare longingly at the grounds. Sometimes he stole into the yard and peered through the windows into the house's fine interior. But it was Charles whom Jesse modeled himself after in small but meaningful ways. Like so many working-class Southern black men, he worked tirelessly for the city's white business owners. Jackson would later note that it was from Charles that he learned what peaceful, dignified resistance could look like. It was enough to put food on the family's table. After landing a job at the post office, a majestic granite and marble edifice, in 1954 the hard-working Charles was finally able to move the family into a housing project that featured sturdy brick walls and hot and cold running water. For the first time, Jesse lived in a residence that featured closets, a pantry, and a television. Jackson's material conditions were improving markedly. He, like many poor and working-class black Americans in the South, was inching ever so slightly toward a world in which the stark caste system enforced by Jim Crow no longer held as much sway. And yet, his childhood was still marked by the deep racial inequalities that permeated Greenville and much of the rest of the country. Blacks were forced to worship in black-only churches, attend black-only schools, and live in black-only neighborhoods. Downtown restaurants, lunch counters, theaters, and libraries were off-limits. Blacks were separated from whites on trains, on buses, and in state and federal buildings. They couldn't walk on the lawn of the state capitol. Swimming pools and water fountains were delineated with whites-only signs. And like in so much of the United States at the time, blacks paid taxes but could not fully exercise the franchise. Jackson recalls walking past the city jails, which were right in the heart of downtown. They were full to the brim of young black men arrested for minor offenses. The men called out to passersby by name, "Tell Mom I'm in here." "Tell Daddy I'm in here," Jackson told me. As a child, frustration, humiliation, and fear all stirred inside him. He was vividly living the sickening reality of 20th century American racism. As a young boy, for example, he had to walk 5 miles to attend a segregated school, even though an elementary school for whites was located blocks from his house. Making matters worse, his classmates taunted him mercilessly for being born out of wedlock. "Your daddy ain't none of your daddy," the other children would jeer. "You ain't nothing but a nobody." The combination of racial and interpersonal prejudice fueled in Jackson an immense desire and energy to succeed, to be a leader of men. Highly intelligent and fiercely competitive, he was a favorite with teachers and community leaders. Those who knew him at the time knew there was something different about Jesse, whether they liked it or not. The older he grew, the more friends and relatives noticed his increasing resemblance to Noah Robinson. Like his stepfather Charles, Jesse was a hard worker, taking odd jobs outside school to increase his family's income. He delivered wood, waited tables, caddied at a country club, worked at a hotel, and later held a relatively high-paying job at the local post office. Encouraged by Helen and Tibby, he also actively volunteered in his neighborhood, including reading to illiterate adults. His mother had engaged in this same activity for years. A high school graduate, Helen was a go-to for many older men and women in the community who had never learned to read or write. She would read the newspaper to them, help them fill out their Social Security papers, and assist them with their finances. Her assistance didn't go unrecognized. At times when the family's money was particularly tight, bags of groceries would suddenly appear on the front porch, courtesy of one of her pupils. Those experiences left a big impression on Jackson, who considered such offerings to be spiritual bread cast on the water, returning toasted with butter on it, as he later recalled. They reinforced in him the importance of community in surviving life's hardships. Helen and Tibby also lectured Jesse on the importance of education. Though Tibby herself was illiterate, she would frequently borrow books and magazines for Jesse to read from the upper-class whites whose homes she cleaned. Tibby had also encouraged Helen to finish high school despite her pregnancy. Both women recognized Jesse's extreme inquisitiveness and intelligence. Helly and Tibby were enthusiastic congregants of the local Long Branch Baptist Church, and religious activities, including weekly Sunday school, played a big role in young Jesse's life. He was transfixed by the grand oratory of the minister, Reverend D.S. Sample. The stirring celebratory music of the gospel thrilled him. He paid close attention not only to the message, but also to the powerful call and response of Reverend Sample and the chanting, clapping congregation. Church, he perceived, was the true democracy. Black and white, poor and rich, were equal in the eyes of God. Jesse pictured himself in Reverend Sample's place at the pulpit, urging the faithful forward regardless of their struggles. In his early years, Jackson fought a stutter, but whenever he spoke in front of groups, it disappeared. At age 9, he presented a speech at his church's Christmas pageant. The congregation was so impressed by his fiery oration that they gathered money to send him to a National Sunday School Convention in North Carolina. From then on, he was a regular speaker at the church. He told Noah Robinson that he had dreamed one night of leading his followers across raging rivers. Though they never lived under the same roof, Noah was a constant presence in Jesse's thoughts. He admired his birth father's financial success and the way he stood proud while interacting with white people. Noah had the ability, one of Jackson's friends remembered, to relate to white people as much as one could in the segregated South as an equal. Jesse was determined to emulate Noah's example. Those who know Jackson well acknowledge that to understand the man, it is imperative to understand this cauldron of his personal instability and complexity he grew up in. He succeeded in spite of it, and in a way, some argue, it brought him closer to the experience of the everyday American and those alienated from the elite circles in which he was destined to travel decades later. Jackson would later describe it this way: "People would say I had a father deficit when in truth I had a father surplus. The truth was perhaps both at once." As a high schooler, Jackson was a star academically and athletically. He was class president and a member of the student council and the National Junior Honor Society. But his athleticism gave him a ticket out of Greenville. He was the starting quarterback at the Sterling High Tigers football team, a position in which his physical and intellectual prowess was both on display. As Coach J.D. Mathis often noted, Jackson could walk up to the line of scrimmage and immediately identify the weak spots in the opponent's defense. Coach Mathis was known to push his players relentlessly, leading them through famously grueling daily practices at Mayberry Park. He regularly patrolled the Sterling High halls to make sure his players were in class and taking their studies seriously. "I'm still playing quarterback," Jackson later said. "I still must look at the defense, strategize, and execute with the expectation of success. That's what Coach Mathis taught." That was an excerpt from the first chapter of the book, A Dream Deferred, Jesse Jackson and the Fight for Black Political Power, written by Abby Phillip. This excerpt appeared at the website of the book's publisher, Macmillan. That website is us.macmillan.com. I'm going to wrap up today's African American Hour with another excerpt from the book, A Dream Deferred. This excerpt is from the CNN.com website. This excerpt focuses on Jesse Jackson's 1988 campaign bid and his main competitor for the Democratic nomination, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. Jesse Jackson convened half a dozen of his closest advisors in his Chicago home. For the first time, he was beginning to lay out what he would have to do to build an actual presidency if he were to become the nominee. There was plenty to fear, too. In his own mind, the gravity of the presidency, or the potential of it, descended on him all at once. This was the same man who wore a bulletproof jacket provided to him by the Secret Service as a matter of course during both his campaigns. But for the first time, he was discussing with his closest aides what they would do about cabinet positions and White House appointments. He was seriously thinking for the first time, "Wait a second, this could be doable," recalled campaign manager Jerry Austin, a white Jewish man from New York with a long history of political campaigns in the heartland. "By that time, we had some momentum, and the issues that we raised were resonating, Jackson said. Our issues were on time, issues about economic justice and shared economic security, a connection between family farms and urban workers, how blacks and whites and browns had to relate together, so it was in full gear. We used to call it poor campaign, rich message. Our message was winning. A similar realization had come to Democratic Party officials, who watched in shock as Jackson beat Dukakis 2-1 in a key industrial Midwestern state. The Michigan victory would, potentially briefly, leave Jackson with an outright delegate lead, a nightmare scenario for some in the party. The party is up against an extraordinary endgame, Democratic pollster Paul Maslin told the New York Times. If this guy has more convention votes than anyone else, how can we not nominate him? But how can we nominate him? Others were blunter, though unwilling to put their names on the record. They whispered about denying Jackson the nomination if he entered the convention with the most delegates. I'm not saying that he can do that, one anonymous party veteran told the Times. But if he could, we would be in an impossible situation. We'd have the choice of turning our backs on Jesse and alienating the blacks, or nominating him and almost certainly losing in November. The Dukakis campaign was suddenly under the microscope. The Massachusetts governor had plenty going for him organizationally, but almost nothing that gripped the hearts of primary voters. We must acknowledge the strength of Jackson's message, one of Dukakis' supporters, Senator Donald Regal of Michigan, said. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers were skeptical about Dukakis the man and the uninspiring campaign he was running. Even if they wanted to stop Jackson, they were trapped. They were deathly afraid of being called racist for opposing a black candidate, but were convinced that if Jackson were the nominee, the Republicans would run away with the race in historic fashion. The relationship between Jackson and Austin, his campaign manager, had been cordial but uneasy until this point. Unlike many people around Jackson, Austin was not a longtime loyalist. Yet the victory in Michigan seemed to act as a pressure valve, releasing some of the distrust Jackson may have felt for Austin, at least temporarily. The campaign finally seemed to be getting its footing, with Austin's arrival and a more sophisticated finance team being brought on. Jackson was well positioned to take advantage of the financial windfalls that came from his better-than-expected performances on Super Tuesday. He was continuing to run, by far, the leanest of the campaigns still in the field. But the sudden uptick in fundraising among smaller donations and larger checks caught the attention of his rivals. The campaign began using mail solicitations to fundraise, and with each campaign victory, raising money from wealthy donors became easier. On that front, Jackson was playing catch-up with the other, more establishment candidates in the race. But where none of them could touch his candidacy was with his small-dollar appeal. It was one of the great gifts Jackson had, taken straight from the pulpit. At rallies and campaign events, in churches and high school gyms, the ask would start at $1,000. Could anyone spare $1,000? Not one hand in the room went up, nor did Jackson expect that any would. The ask then went down to $500, then to $50, then $20, and $10. Until virtually every hand in the room was raised and people put up what they had into the collection hat. Afterward, I said to him, "Why do you start asking for $1,000? There's nobody in this church with $1,000, Austin recalled. And he said, "When I get to who will give me something, everybody will give me something." They were buying into his campaign, Austin said. It was past time for Jackson to begin to calm the nerves of the party establishment in Washington. With the help of former DNC chair John C. White and Burt Lance, former budget director for President Jimmy Carter, the campaign gathered around 35 Democrats representing a cross-section of fundraisers, party officials, and task makers in a ballroom at the Jefferson Hotel in D.C. Jackson worked the room. The aim was to raise the comfort level of party officials. One attendee called it a tranquilizer for the Democratic Party chattering class. A lot of those kinds of people wind up making up public opinion in a very small subset, said Ann Lewis. This was about, at the most basic level, relieving people's anxiety because I consistently thought Jesse had been so underestimated and not quite caricatured, but unfairly portrayed by the press. And for people to see him as he really was, which was this smart, thoughtful guy and someone who really wanted the Democratic Party to succeed, they didn't know that. Jackson was buoyant as he went into Wisconsin ahead of its April 5th primary. The crowd seemed to validate the growing interest in his candidacy. He and his campaign were confident that he could appeal to the state's college towns and urban communities. Jackson had high hopes for the state, where his rallies had been enthusiastically received even in white farming communities. They held a rally on the border between Minnesota and Wisconsin. Paul Wellstone, who would later become a progressive U.S. senator from Minnesota, was Jackson's state director there. A crowd nearly the size of the town's population of 2,800 showed up in rural Amory, Wisconsin to hear Jackson speak. As they gathered on the Blue Fay Dairy Farm, there was almost as much appreciation for Jackson showing up there as for his message. The truly impressive thing is, here's a black man coming up to rural Wisconsin, to a community where all the blacks could fill that barn and there would still be a lot of room, said Skip Shireman, a 61-year-old retired school teacher. There was interest, no doubt, in Jackson's candidacy and message, but the campaign was ill-equipped to capture the curiosity and transform it into votes. There were memorable messages, to be sure. We will choose farms over arms in this generation. But Jackson was characteristically short on specifics. If anything, his candidacy was beginning to be a repository for disenchantment with the rest of the Democratic field. The man has something to say, said Bob Janke, an electric plant worker who came out to see Jackson. We had U.S. Representative Dick Gephardt in Dukakis here last Saturday. Gephardt had somewhat of a message, but Dukakis didn't say much. In more moderate La Crosse, old party hands who had thrown their support behind Dukakis or Gore found discord in their own homes. My mother is voting for Jesse Jackson. My sister is voting for Jesse Jackson, a state representative who had thrown his hat in for Gore told a reporter. I can't even convince my own family to vote for Al Gore. The energy around Jackson's candidacy was unmistakable and set his opponent's more traditional campaigns in stark relief. As the April 5th primary approached, Dukakis was feeling the pressure to better define himself and his candidacy in the minds of uninspired voters. I have no interest in being known as the great communicator, he said. I want to be known as the great builder. I want to make the American dream come alive again. Jackson's growing populist appeal was rising just as rapidly as the panic among establishment Democrats and the party faithful. A U.S. News and World Report poll put a Jackson-led presidential ticket far behind Vice President George H.W. Bush in a general election. Meanwhile, a Dukakis-led ticket with Jackson as vice president would narrowly beat Bush. The survey quantified persistent reservations among the electorate about Jackson's candidacy. Those two forces came crashing together in spectacular fashion on election night in Wisconsin. Thanks to Michigan, the expectations were sky-high for Jackson. Austin's strategy banked on defying expectations by overperforming among white voters in a state where Jackson could not necessarily rely on a large black vote for credibility. But the Michigan victory changed all that. It refocused attention in the media on the question of electability and set victory as the standard that Jackson had to meet. By Election Day, the tides had turned, and Dukakis pulled out a decisive victory. We got creamed, Austin said. Instead of securing an easy victory that his large, enthusiastic crowd suggested, Jackson finished second. In a poll around the primary, about a third of the primary voters said management skills and the candidate's experience were the main factors that determined their vote, and that group overwhelmingly supported Dukakis. Wisconsin was the end of the hope that you might actually have this miracle take place, Borisov said. Dukakis's message of competence, not charisma, worked. Jackson performed better with white voters, but any momentum he was hoping for after Michigan was gone. In Wisconsin, there were people who would have voted for Jesse but didn't want him to be the nominee because they didn't think he could win, Austin said. Dukakis was a safe haven. Despite a groundswell of grassroots support for Jackson's insurgent campaign, it was never matched by elected Democrats and party leaders. Jackson finished second to Dukakis in the 1988 primary, but secured leverage at the Democratic National Convention. He used it to push through a series of changes to the Democratic Party's platform and rules, including one that would become pivotal in another primary where a black candidate, Barack Obama, sought the nomination against a more establishment figure. Jackson hoped that he would be considered seriously as running mate to Dukakis. The two men and their wives met at Dukakis's Brookline, Massachusetts home in the lead-up to the convention. But ultimately, Dukakis chose a white Southerner, Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas. After a sharply negative general election campaign against Vice President George H.W. Bush, Dukakis lost in an electoral landslide. That was an excerpt from a new book about Jesse Jackson titled A Dream Deferred, Jesse Jackson and the Fight for Black Political Power, written by Abby Phillip. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.